What I want to talk about is really to complement what Henry is doing and what many of you in the audience are doing in optimization, an interest in optimization, from talking it literally as this seminar is supposed to be, from the industry perspective. So I'm really going to be talking problem formulation. A lot of what you're going to see today is a lot of pictures to motivate really the mathematics that lies underneath it. I want to say the following. Optimization theory, as it stands right now, with some of the work that Henry was talking about in semi-definite programming, the work that's matured in interior point methods, that Tamash and Henry and others have looked at, and work in convex programming, discrete optimization, it's really now ripe for the picking for many of the engineers that need to solve very, very large problems that I'm going to talk about. And for those in the audience, if your background's in mathematics and you spend time understanding this more and more, Tamash and Henry are examples of it because they're colleagues of mine that work at it, you really set up yourself to really deal with some very interesting problems where engineers, and especially design engineers, have no solutions. What's happening right now, what I'm going to talk about, as chip design gets into the what we call the nanometer range, 100 nanometers, it's close to that. It's about 0.18 submicrons, which is 180 nanometers. A lot of the physics, a lot of the problems that the electrical engineers are dealing with, crosstalk, hotspots, all of the physics that needs to be dealt with is now coming back full circle in the design of computer chips. At the same time, if you don't have it laid out properly, in other words, you don't put the modules where they should be, the transistors where they should be, wire them properly, you make the physics problems, the hotspot problems, the crosstalk problems, and the design problems almost impossible. I was recently at a symposium at Albany, at the University of Albany, SUNY at Albany. Albany Nanotech is a big consortium that Governor Pataki in New York has set up to look at the problems that we're facing. Henry was talking about protein folding, biological systems, pharmaceutical systems, electronic systems. And they're literally the companies that we're talking at the symposium, it was academics and companies getting together, is they're just scared about the literal problems that the physics are going to cause, the biology has to deal with, and the mathematics and engineering has to deal with, for example, in the nanoelectronics design. That's what's going out there, folks. And what's happening is companies like Intel, IBM, the companies that are involved in chip design, let me stay close to home here, are really hiring more and more of and importing more and more of the mathematics tools, especially in optimization, to help them out with those kinds of designs. More and more of my colleagues that are being hired are not from electrical and computer engineering. Lord knows I dealt with it as a chair of a department in electrical and computer engineering, but I'm seeing more opportunities for computer scientists, for mathematicians to actually go there. So for those of you here in the audience that are doing PhD studies or postdocs, those are areas where you should be looking at, and if I can also help you, please let me know that. So today I'm going to be doing a missionary work in terms of what we're doing there, and then we're going to get into the mathematics of this talk. Now, the outline is that that was my introduction. Is we're going to be talking about global routing, and in leading into global routing, I want to talk about some of the other design problems that one is facing here. These are all NP-hard problems. Let me start with that. So the designers, the ones who have to actually make these chips, obviously have to deal with heuristics and obviously fast running time algorithms, to approximate the solutions to the problem. So they're looking for order n log n, like sorting time, order n algorithms, because some of the transistors that are on like Pentium chips are now approaching 40, 50 million transistors and are projected by Moore's law to hit well over 400 million over the next few years. The modeling techniques that we're going to be looking at today are going to be an example, and I'm going to take you into a CAD engineer's thinking of how they attack this with a mathematician's point of view of where they can come in. So that's where I'm going to take you today. The optimization techniques we're going to talk about are classical interior point methods, really primal dual methods, predictor corrector methods that many of you know about. There's nothing fancy in that, except that if you take a look at some of the ordering schemes and some of the structure in the problem that you're looking at, you can speed up the results to this problem. And at the end, I'm also going to draw some summary and conclusions and some future work that one's looking at. Now, the mathematics in my talk today, I brought in 30 preprints of a paper that was accepted actually yesterday from Informs Journal on Computing that describes this talk. So the details of that are here, and if anyone wants it, please pick it up afterwards. So what I want to make the audience here deal with today is get at ease to understand where I'm heading with this. The details are here, so certainly you can fill that in afterwards. Now, the major contribution here is that we're really dealing with root construction techniques. And today's a good example. I was going crazy trying to get here from Waterloo to Toronto in less than 3 hours so I could give this talk. And the problem is my routes were congested. And if I knew the city better, I could look at alternate routes so that they're longer paths but shorter time in essence. That's the way I'd like to get this audience thinking, is how do you find alternate paths if you're going to do wiring? All right. So what's happened is the designers have actually taken the transistors, have laid it out to make it simple on a two-dimensional area. You can think of this floor as a big chip. You've put the modules down in this grid. Now you want to connect them. And obviously, if you want to connect point A to point B, you're thinking locally. When you're driving a car, you don't care about anybody else on the road. We know that. Everybody wants to get to their mother's house. You're going from point A to point B as quickly as you can get to it. The problem is, when you're looking at shortest paths and limited highway traffic, unless you're in Italy, I guess you can use all kinds of roads, you are limited to the number of widths that you can travel to do the wiring. So the thing is, if you can't do that feasibly, there is a feasibility issue, how do you find alternate paths in an efficient way to solve it? That's the problem I'm going to be talking about today in English. Okay, we're going to be looking at some congestion estimation techniques. That's really what's embedded in this idea, how you can estimate it better. And then some flexible and powerful multi-objective formulations to actually deal with things like wire length, congestion, and other factors in the design. And there are enhancements of some numerical techniques to actually solve the global routing problem efficiently, which I'll touch on at the end. Now, the chips here that we're looking at, this is a Pentium 4 chip. Integrated circuits really have millions of transistors. As I said, right now there are well over 40 million transistors that are in the current chips. If I use the term VLSI, or you hear that, it means very large scale integration that we're talking about. When an engineer at IBM or Intel sits down, Motorola sits down to design a chip, the engineers are thinking of, okay, how can I reduce the delay in the chip? How can I make sure that the power is kept as small as possible? And you can appreciate that with modern devices, these PDAs that suck up a lot of power and everything, and battery life is limited, they got to deal with chips that don't drain that much power with all the features that you put on. These are issues they deal with. And the size, they want to obviously keep them small because of what they're trying to use them for. If you're dealing with people that have heart conditions and you want to monitor them regularly in the future, you obviously want the devices inside them to be as small as possible and as non-invasive as possible. So the chips now have reached that point where that can happen. Now the routing or the wiring is one of the most important factors that you are dealing with in VLSI design. The Intel processors, just to give you a little bit of history, for those of you who can remember back in 1982 when maybe you got your first computer and it cost actually $5,000, which was a lot of money, it actually had 134,000 transistors. This was the old 8286 computers. And it was a 1.5 micron chip that was actually built by Intel. It eventually then went to the 386, which was 275, and you can see the doubling effect that we're looking at here in 1985, 4 years later. The 8486 went over a million transistors, and that was such a big deal. That went to 1 micron, so that's still about 1,000 nanometers that we're talking about. Then it went into the Pentium class, the chips we're looking at now in the last 10 years. 1993, it was 3 million, it was 0.8 microns. The Pentium Pro was in 1995, 10 years ago, it was 0.6. And the Pentium 4, which was introduced 4 years ago, it was at 46 million. I haven't put in the more modern chips that Intel is now coming up with. They're close to 100 million transistors, and they're approaching 0.1 micron, and in some cases 0.08 micron technology. That's how much they've compacted it in. Engineers like making things small just to drive themselves crazy sometimes. I don't know why they do this. They don't have to in all cases, but Intel takes pride in doing this. Right? But by doing this, they introduce some interesting problems right now. Just explain what's happening. An electrical engineer basically connects things by wires. When wires get too close together, which is what's happening in the 100 nanometer range or 180 nanometer range, this last one here, as the wires get close to each other, atoms start jumping across, electrons start jumping across. It leads to a lot of design problems that engineers don't want to deal with, but now they need physicists to deal with the issue of how they can keep things in the paths on how they bring them over. And that's why right now what's going to happen here, just for this audience, is there's a big move, and you've heard about quantum computing. In quantum computing, what they're trying to do is replace the wires, which is electricity and still moving electrons, with dealing with photons and photon detection. That will be the transistor. How do we set up transistors to deal with light so that we can minimize those problems? And that's off into the future. My personal thought, quantum computing will probably take the same time to do fusion, to have a fusion reactor, which might be 50 to 60 to 100 years. It is a good hype. It's good talk, but the problems that have to be overcome at the physical level are huge. But this is where designers want to go, and we have to have that hope. But it's going to take a huge effort of physics, mathematics, and a lot of other areas of science to resolve those problems. Okay? So here's what we're dealing with. So we're pushing 50 million plus transistors. We're laying this out, and we got to wire them. Okay? And also keep it simple for this audience. What's nice here in many of the transistors that are connected, except for the things that bring the power into the chip to make it function, most of them are like a graph. It's really an embedded graph underneath of two modules connected to each other, maybe three or four modules in a hyper edge connected to each other. So there's really a graph connection that you're dealing with underneath. Okay? Now, the architectural design, the VLSI design, has actually five components, but it has more embedded around them. The engineer comes up with what do we want this thing to do, and performance, etc. So there's an architectural design that comes up at the transistor level that they want to establish. They then go into logic design here and the circuit design to actually deal with setting up how the chip will come to be. And the circuit design is exactly going into the transistor level of actually how you design the chip, the circuit, to give you the performance of the overall system that you're building. It's a system. And then there's the physical design and the fabrication, which is the hard part now of actually how do you perform the masks, how you deal with metal and silicon. I'll give you examples of this so that you can actually produce this device. What's happening on top, as you know, there's input-output. There's control unit, there's memory embedded presumably in the device that you're dealing with, and there's data path and flow of information that has to go through the physical device to make it do what you want it to do. As I said, in the logic design, what happens is these are what are called gates. Basically, it's inputs and outputs. It's a multi-input, multi-output system. Depending on what goes in, you could have several inputs in and several outputs out. Normally, it's one output out. That you add them, multiplex them, multiply them, whatever you do to the inputs, you process them, then it feeds into other multi-inputs of the system. That's the logic design. The circuit is when you start getting into actually seeing how physically this will operate, how will the linkages occur. And on the physical design and fabrication, which is the pictures that many of you see, you actually start laying it out depending on the technology you're using in certain ways. There are what are called gate arrays, standard cells, macro cell layouts, and right now chip-to-chip design where you put chips within chips, and that's what they're trying to do when they lay this out. And the final part is the fabrication. And this is at the lowest level where we've taken a microscopic image of actually the connections that are going on. And this is actually signals that are going between layers in the actual chip that you have. Modern chips right now have multiple layers of silicon and metal that are alternating. And they're stacked basically like an apartment building with an elevator shaft being the via to bring signals up and down. So it allows that to connect up and down. So you have like multi-layouts that's going on in multiple layers. Okay, so that makes the problem very, very hard conceptually and mathematically. To look at the thinking that goes on as the designer progresses, I'm trying to take you through the thinking, and I want to stay there for this hour with you, is you want to place the modules first. I'm going to talk about wiring, but you want to place the modules on this two-dimensional area, which could have alternating layers of metal and silicon. So layers of two-dimensional layers that are put on top of each other. And you want to run the wire between them to connect them. Let me back up here. If I have like this collection, there's actually a name here of one of my PhD students that Henry knows and Tomas knows. This is the one who worked on this part of the work. You take the components, which in this case would be the transistors, and you're trying to organize it in a way that makes sense conceptually, that things that, let's say, are doing the processing hang together. Things that actually deal with memory hang together. And it's not just the components that are strictly memory, it's the things that are close to memory that operate that way. So in your mind, as we all do, we cluster things. We partition things into components that we can better analyze. And ideally, you want to minimize interconnections between these components so that the problems that you solve in the subcomponents stay there and are as solved as best as possible. That's what we try to do here. So, for example here, you're trying to place, her name was Lale Bejat. The name came out by an organization of putting it in a two-dimensional area, whether it's in two layers, three layers, whatever you want to do. And there are algorithms to actually do this so that you actually are minimizing the wire length, minimizing the delay, and what's very popular with designers right now is minimizing power, because battery life on many of the devices we're now using is so limited, that won't change anytime soon. That the circuit designers, really, power is a big deal for companies that produce these devices, like Motorola or these computers that run out of power, as you know, soon enough. Now, circuit layout is really divided into three areas that are mathematically based. All right, we talk about mathematics here: partitioning, placement, and routing. The partitioning is what I just talked about before. The chips are organized so that they're broken down into several subcomponents that hang together. They function together as an entity. And what designers try to do is minimize the coupling between these components so that if they're doing a design and they got limited time and there's a problem in a component, it doesn't propagate to the rest of the chip. Because companies like Intel put designers on these subcomponents. They don't put it on the whole thing. Then they get together and make sure that things are communicating well with each other. So they don't want the problems to really propagate too much over the whole system, but they usually do if you do a terrible design. The routing is the partitioning is what I said, is breaking this up into components with weak coupling. Placement is then to organize it in the two-dimensional area so that ideally these areas, these ideal objectives, wire length, area, power, are kept as small as possible. And then the wiring is actually to, once you've obtained the placement, is to actually physically do the connection and wire and do the connections of the modules that must have power brought to each other. And that's what I'm talking about on routing. The back one is what's called a global routing, where the designers, that's what I'm going to be talking about today, try to get it so that things are approximately where they should be in the wire sense. And then the details of actually how you do that is called a detail routing. And that allows you to actually connect what are called vias, the points, these elevator shafts, to actually do the wiring right at that level. That's the last part that is done. These previous two parts, the placement and the global routing, is what designers do to get everything in the neighborhood that it looks right. And then they do the fine tuning with some very sophisticated computer aided design packages to do the actual physical layout fabrication of the chip. Now, global routing is used to find approximate path for the wires connecting the modules. What we're trying to do is, after we have the placement, is answer two questions. One, can the wiring be done? First and foremost, the designer wants to know that. And how off are we going to be? If we can't do it, is it 10% of the wires I can't wire? 20%? How bad is it? The designer wants to know that. More importantly, if you're lucky and you say, yes, we can wire, then you want to do it as efficiently as possible to minimize several objectives. Usually what I'm going to talk about here is wire length. You try to keep the wiring as short as possible because that tends to deal with everything else in a good way. Power tends to be reduced, area tends to be reduced, etc. This is an MP-hard problem. It is difficult to solve for large problems, and the solution quality can affect the performance of the circuit. So depending on what you do, it will or will not perform well and lead into a chip that responds the way you want it to respond. I want to give you an illustrative example here. Here we have what are called two nets. A net, mathematical sense, is a hyperedge. It connects two or more modules. And from an electrical engineering perspective, it's a signal. A signal can actually be connected in several ways. It could be multiple inputs or outputs that work together. So that's called a net. So we have here a net in red and a net here in this diamond triangle that we have here that we have to connect. So these modules, the red ones, these four red ones have been put over here. And I see this is, eyes are following me. It's driving me nuts. And then we have these green modules over here that actually also have to be connected. So how do you wire them? Now, this example here in red, what we've done is we've connected the four wires, sort of a, well, in a baseball term, around the horn. You go here, you go to the top, you go across, and you go straight down to these two ones over here. And in orange, you connect the green this way across. Right? And again, keep thinking traffic flow and dealing with congestion. That's what we're going to be talking about the rest of the way here. There's two techniques for solving global routing. And designers, engineering designers, work very efficiently and very simply in how they attack it. The first one's what's called sequential routing. They say, okay, we've got it placed. Let's take the first net. Let's route it. Let's take the second net in whatever order you want to do it or randomly, and they just go down the list. And guess what happens? At some point, you get stuck. Right? If you permute it, you might get lucky. You might resynchronize it so that you can go a little further. But these algorithms eventually get stuck, and there's always at the end some percentage of routes that you can't wire, where in theory or in reality, if you were God, you know you can wire those things. You just haven't done it. You shouldn't do it in a sequential way. What's becoming more prevalent, and here's to the math programming, is that the math programming techniques, you're actually trying to look at the big picture. You're looking at all the nets that have to be routed, and you want to do it at the same time. That's the correct way of doing it. So if you're dealing with a traffic flow problem, and for the sake of argument, you knew what everybody around you is doing as they're driving, there can be give and take so that the congestion is reduced and that you can get to the same places together. So it's a matter of what math programming does is allows a sharing of resources so that the math programming problem is solved efficiently and the problem is solved efficiently. That's the beauty of math programming for these kinds of areas. Now, the sequential routing, as I said, the nets are ordered according to importance. Now, the designers say, look, I've got this wire that actually brings the power into the net. That's my key wire. They're going to route that one first. They're going to make sure that they deal with that. And then some of the ones that deal with some logic that is not as important, they might leave last. But still, they do have to wire all of this because of the functionality. You can't skip things here. Okay, you can get in a lot of trouble. So each net is routed separately. And as I said here, they'd establish a priority list. So for example here, if red's more important than green for the connection in this case here, you start doing the red first, and then you do the green last. As I said here, you have this white wire that now will connect the red, these four points, in this way, sort of a zigzag fashion. And that net length here is four. We're just using these units. These are squares, so they're all the same. One, two, three, four. I'm going to be using these terms throughout the talk. And then in green, you can actually go across here, up, and across here. Now notice, for the electrical engineers in the crowd, you've got a problem in the middle here. If you were doing this on one layer, you have a short circuit because you can't cross like that. What's assumed here, there's a layer of silicon that's on top of that, so you can bring it upstairs, and then it won't cause a short circuit here, just for the engineers here, or the physicists here. Now, the sequential routing, what we had here is then if you add up these wires, it's 5 this way and 4 this way. It's a total wire length of 9. The solution, as I said, is dependent on the net ordering. So as you're trying to reduce, as I said, short circuits or capacity that you want to do for the wiring, the wire lengths tend to get very big. That's the big downside with sequential routing. By the way, Intel, IBM still use these techniques. Okay, they've made them more efficient with some what we call maze runner techniques that work better, but this is the basis of still many of the CAD packages they do because they're very, very fast. Now, the way the math programming problem does, and this is where I'm going to set it up for you, is that you set up alternate routes for a wiring. Now, for example, here, in connecting just the red points that we're looking at here, okay, I'm going to set up 3 routes, this red one, the white one, and this yellow one here. And I'm going to call it a Boolean variable, Y1, Y2, and Y3, saying that I either select it or I don't. Right? So I'm just going to set up the basics of the math programming problem underneath it. It's an integer programming problem. So here the red one goes across as we had on top, connects the 4 wires. The yellow one goes down and across. We had this in the previous one. It's a zigzag. And then the yellow one actually goes from the top here down across and here. Sorry, the green one is here. That's don't let it throw you. It's the red dots that we're connecting here. And again, as I said, the YIs, this should be YI, are 1 if the route is selected and 0 otherwise. So here is the basis of what I want to talk about in the formulation of the problem. For each net, we generate a sequence of routes. And I'm going to show you routes that are good, routes that are bad. Depending on the routes that you have here, obviously you want to select one of them. So for each net, you can only choose one of these. So you're going to put in a constraint, Y1 plus Y2 plus Y3 is equal to 1. And then in the objective function, we have a weight in front of each of these variables, which is based, for example, here on wire length. 1 is 4, 1 is 5, 1 is 3. So you want to minimize that wire length. So you're going to pick the one, obviously, with the smallest wire length, ideally. And then you want to make sure that you route all of them, because all of these can be routed this way. Now, how do we select these routes? The mathematical programming problem, as I said, is a minimization with these weights, which we'll talk about a little bit in a bit, in front of these Boolean variables. And there's really 2 types of constraints, as I just said. Each net, only one route can be chosen. So you have these assignment constraints, the sum of yi's is equal to 1, and that the number of routes passing through a channel cannot exceed the maximum channel capacity. So again, this is back to the street problem. If you have a capacity of 4 roads, of 4 lanes in which traffic can go through, you can't exceed that. As I said, I was making the joke of Italy, nobody caught it. Unless you're in areas like that, you have to stay within the constraints that you're dealing with. So in the problem here, you have these really constraints that are generated. It turns out that the problem we're looking at, if you have about M modules, you basically have, then for each, you also have about the same order of nets. So if you have M modules, you have in the order of about 2 to 3 M nets. It's not M squared, it's a linear amount, okay? And I want you to work with me on this. So each of those nets, let's say about 3 or 4 M of them, have one of these constraints where the routes are selected. Now, for the routes, the variables, are basically what are generated for the number of nets is about 4 to 5 times that. So it's about, it goes from 4 M, then all of a sudden it goes to about 20 M routes that are generated. These are the discrete Boolean variables that one has to look at. M is about anywhere from 10 to 40 million, okay? So you're looking at about a problem that could be 800 million variables and about 20 million constraints that you're dealing with. That's the size of the problem you're dealing with. If you guys want a large-scale linear programming problem, this is the one to look at, Okay. Now, you're not going to solve it this way. You're going to do a lot of clustering. That's why I brought the partitioning. You keep it in a reasonable area so that generally the problem size you're dealing with here is anywhere between, still big, between 10 and 50,000 constraints and about the same number of variables, give or take. All right, so I just want to put it in perspective. But the real problem would be close to 200 million up to almost a billion variables that you're dealing with. Now, the big constraint is this, is that the binary, okay, and it's, the NP-hard's got to be somewhere. This is where it shows up. What's interesting in here is that we've observed is that with the variation in wire lengths or the weights that you put in front of the variables, when you relax the requirement of binary constraints so that, let's say, the yi's are between 0 and 1, most of the solutions to this problem come out one of two ways. It's infeasible, you can't find the solution, which gets back to the original problem, or it's feasible and it's mostly 0-1. The solutions that come out, even when you that come out, are close to 0-1. You need very little rounding. If you round, you're actually off from the real solution, which is about 0.1% away. So it gives you very high quality answers solving with math programming. Interior point, polynomial time. So it runs very, very quickly to solve this problem. The drawback is that there is a large possible number of possible routes that can occur. Each route is a binary variable in the optimization problem, and the optimization problem can become very large and hard to solve, especially if you make it push it up to that level. I'll give you an example here. MCNC is a microelectronics corporation of North Carolina. They have test beds of circuits that companies put into a repository. It's like NetLib for circuits. And what MCNC does is they keep these circuits for testing so that if you have a great algorithm, you should beat the best results that are reported. A simple one called FRACT, it's actually Benoit Mandelbrot had a fractal theory circuit that he designed at IBM. It actually had 147 nets, and when we looked at it, we generated all the routes for this one. It was over 28,000 routes. If we were generating all the routes, including long ones, long wires, and short wires, it could generate quite a large number. We're not going to do that. To keep it in range, you want to make sure that you're not generating all the routes. You're generating routes that deal with certain measures that reduce certain other measures. The main one we want to talk about is congestion measure. We want to actually reduce the congestion that exists in these routes. Now, what we're going to try to do is generate the least number of routes as possible. We want to have the least amount of congestion, and I'll show you pictures of what I mean by congestion. But the congestion is really, if you think of it, in traffic again, is in certain parts of the city that you're looking at. Like Toronto might be the whole city, but generally you have certain parts of the city are much more congested in other areas, presumably on the extremities. This happens again in chip design. So you want to try to find you want to have this congestion balanced out in the chip. So you want to develop a multi-objective modeling technique to deal with this. Now, the routes are construction that we're going to use is the following. We want to limit the number of routes considered by making only minimum length and minimal bend routes. Now this, again, from graph theory, is we're going to look at setting up a minimal Steiner tree. So we're looking at a rectilinear distance and connecting points. We want to find the minimum distance between any of these points. That's called a Steiner tree, a minimal degree Steiner tree. This can result in suboptimal and sometimes feasible solutions because you're reducing the search space, right? You're trying to keep it as small as possible. What we're going to do now is build back up so that we cover it enough so that we can actually do the wiring. All right. So again, this is the basis of this method that we're talking about, is we start with the minimalist number of sets of routes that we want to look at in that set. More than likely, it's infeasible. We can't do the wiring for all the modules that we're looking at, the nets that we're looking at. So we have to add back enough alternate routes, build it up in a controlled manner so that we can solve it and get the optimal solution. And we want to keep this space controlled, and that's where the math programming is used as an iterative technique to solve subsequent problems as we build it back up. Now, for a The route construction, what we're going to look at is we're going to look at congestion techniques to estimate where the additional routes should be generated. And we're also going to limit the size of the problems, and it gives us the feasible and optimal solutions. Now, congestion is defined as follows. In the final solution, there are too many routes in a given channel. That's really what congestion is defined. And congestion areas can cause, as I said, infeasibility, and in a chip, if you've got a Pentium is a good example of a chip that runs very well, but any chip that needs a heat sink on it, a cooling fan, ice cubes put on it to keep it down, it has hot spots in it. The designers have said, no, we got to get this out to market. Let's just put a sink on it, a fan, cool it as much as we can. But those things are designed to fail, as some of you have experienced, because of a poor design in the layout. That's what a hot spot causes, okay? And it's a reflection of the design underneath that may not be well. Let me show you what's happening. These are hot spots, and it's congestion. It's due to congestion. We have these areas in black here. And what's happening is you have wires that are going between either horizontally or vertically through these channels. These are wires. And the black stuff means there's too many of them in this upper left-hand corner, upper right, and across the top. It's a little less here on the far right, and certainly in the bottom left here, again, you're starting to see the same phenomena. Also, the other thing I want you to notice is a lot of white in the middle here. What that's indicating is you don't have very many wires that are running through here in these areas. So what the designers try to do is when they have these congested areas that lead to hotspots, they say, well, you know, we've got these barren areas over here. Can we move some of the wires over there into these white areas so that we can reduce the black here? In other words, you want to get it uniformly spaced. And that's what we're going to try to do here mathematically. We literally start in these local areas and start building alternate routes around these areas here to start bringing the wires across as longer wires here. And you're going to start seeing more black here, less black there, and we try to smear it in a uniform way. That's the idea of what the designers look at. Now, what they do is they still do it locally. They start taking wires in this area, and they do it one by one. Back to that sequential routing. So you've got a poor algorithm, you just stick with it. That's not the idea. We're going to use the math programming to actually drive these in a controlled way globally in one shot. Now, as I said here, we have these areas that I've identified. There are four of them. And what we want to do is sort of disperse them into the center or into these white areas here. Now, the congestion estimation model, that's described in the paper, the number of routes, what you have in the data is the number of routes produced for each net and which edge each route must pass through. And the objective is to estimate the number of routes that might pass through each edge. So we want to actually see in an edge how many routes actually can go through there. We use simple measures. The probability of each route to be chosen at the beginning is 1 over the number of routes in the net, and that's pretty clear. They're all equally probable. So you look at the number of routes in a net, and it's 1 over that. And you hope this number, ideally when you have very few routes, this is a very small number. It's a larger number, excuse me. When you have a lot of choices, a lot of routes, this number gets very close to 0, and it can lead to some problems. The routing demand is also important, or routing demand, RE, is that we look at each edge that a wire can go through, and we say, what is the sum? We look at the sum of the probabilities that routes may pass through that edge. We're saying, what is the likelihood that these routes actually go through that? So we add up these probabilities here running through these edges. I'll give you examples in just a moment. The proposed approach actually calculates the routing demands used to identify congested areas. So we actually use this as a quantitative measure for actually looking at each edge and seeing how much traffic is going through there and for picking alternate routes, and we build it from there. So we generate additional routes for the nets in those areas where congestion is likely to occur, and we can construct additional routes in areas where congestion is less likely to occur. This is back to those white areas where we want to build back up and put some routes in those areas. So that's where we're going to shift the traffic, right? So if you're getting stuck, you can't get into Toronto, you have to look at other paths to get in. That's what you're doing. again, back to the point I made that I want to hope everybody understands is this is the large set that we're dealing with. These are all the roots that we're dealing with. We're not going to do that. What we're going to deal with is really the yellow part is what we start with, is the minimal rectilinear Steiner trees that you start with that may lead to infeasible solutions and usually do. What we're going to do today is in this blue area, light blue, is based on congestion, make a slightly larger set, not by a lot, but leads to feasible solutions that are solved very quickly using interior point methods. That's the end of this talk. Now, the root construction is based on, as I said, we construct the minimum length roots. These are the rectilinear Steiner trees. We estimate the congestion. Then we construct additional roots for congested nets. And then we may have to estimate the congestion again and keep initiating this until we have enough roots that sort of balance out what we're looking at. Then we solve the problem. We could be doing it two ways. We solve it as we go here and then generate more estimate of congestion after we've solved the optimization problem, or you can do it before that. There's some different steps that one could take in this iterative loop at the bottom. Just to indicate what's going on here, the first net is in white here, is the route that connect the red ones. Actually, there's a wire here. This is saying that it can actually can be connected only one way, so that route has a probability of one. Net two, which is connecting the green here, it's the orange and the green. There's actually a white wire here. It's covered. The second net, there's two routes, route two, Y2, which is this orange, goes from the cross here, and then the green one actually goes across the bottom this way here. They're equally likely, there's two routes, so the probability is a half. Now, the routing demands is if you look at these three edges on the other side with the edges, we have edge one, edge two, and edge three here. You're looking at the probabilities, we add up the probabilities of routes going through it. So for example, in edge one, there was only one route that went through it. That was the one Y2. That had a probability of half. That's a half. RE2 is the two edges that go through it. Each had a probability, one had a probability of, this one was one, this was a half, so this is three halves. And then edge three had nothing going through it, so obviously its capacity is zero at this point. So there's, you can stick some things in E3. The problem I think you can appreciate here is if traffic is on this E2 road, there's two wires going through it, and you have this free one up here. Why don't you shift it over? See what happens to these R values when we do that. So here we have now Y4 is actually connecting the four red points this way, so it goes across E3 and down. And then Y1 and Y4, and have been reduced, these probabilities are a half going this way. The routing demands now have balanced out. We had one that was three halves, zero, and a half. It's now gone down. The first route, E1, is a half. E2 is a one, and this one, E3, is a half. So these R values of using the edges have actually come down. The test circuits we describe in the paper actually have vary from nets or wires that we have to route, ranging from 5,000 nets up to 25,000, and they're put on grid sizes that are 46 by 46 up to 66 by 66. Actually, in the reported literature, this is one of the largest ones that's ever been solved with any kind of an optimization technique, okay? And as I said, don't let this fool you. This is used to solve really large problems, but we have those decomposed for the entire big problem, right? The numerical results when we look at this problem is that the following is, we have the original number of roots, which are in green here, the darker green. We then generate additional roots, and by the way, this middle path is the additional roots, and these are really on top of this one here, so it actually should be added on top of the dark green. And the yellow is the additional roots that are actually based on congestion only, okay? So we're doing the routes that are generated based on congestion, which are these green ones here. And this middle one here is some alternate routes that we do just locally to make it slightly larger wire lengths. We don't take the minimal wire lengths. We take some nearby ones. That's this middle group here. But the key one is this yellow one, which are the ones based on congestion. The results for the problems we're looking at, sorry, I should back up here. This is the number of routes that are actually generated. So you can see here, for some of the cases, these six problems we're looking at, especially the largest one, it can run up to about 45,000 routes. These are the number of additional routes here, plus 25,000. So these should be actually added up. It's about 70,000 variables that we're dealing with. And in this set here, we have about 30,000. It's almost about less than half are actually additional congested routes that we have in there. The amount of routing demand that we were looking at, the RE values, as actually, as you add the congestion, this should go down. Remember those RE values that I had? So as you add the congestion, these numbers start dropping for all the problems that we're looking at. And that's the key. It's showing that things are being spread out in the wiring as we deal with it. The other part that also looks at the routing demand is this peak capacity that we're looking at. So before adding the additional trees, we had demand. This is scaled the same way. We had some levels where it exceeded it over here, and then everything starts coming down below these high values that we have. So things are being balanced, and we don't have the congestion as we had before. The traditional approach, as I said, with the model formulation only deals with wire length. What we deal with is we look at several other factors: wire length, congestion, number of bends, and channel capacity. And if congestion, I've already explained what it leads to, is a hotspot. Number of bends is also important because this deals with when you have a bend of a wire in a chip, it usually means you're bringing it to a via, bringing it upstairs to silicon, or down to metal. It actually reduces and introduces delay into the chip. And the channel capacity is the other part that you want to reduce the number of channels that you actually use for the routes to go through. On the remaining time, the numerical results that when we were looking at this one here, the maximum channel capacity we were looking at, as we deal with introducing wire length and what we call here a combined approach, we actually are able, in yellow, to actually reduce both wire length and delay in the chip, whereas this green one actually deals with wire length and doesn't deal with delay. So that actually tends to be a larger values for all the problems that we're looking at. This one led to the same results. And I want to talk about the optimization problem underneath, just for, because this is an optimization talk. The problem we deal with, again, is a standard linear programming problem solved by an interior point method. The problem we have here is very nice because it has a weighted objective. It has these constraints that actually, even though we have assignment constraints where we choose one of the routes equal to one, we can relax that to make it greater than or equal to one. We still can minimize it and solve that problem. We can put it in this form. So it can be put as pure inequalities or mixed equality inequality, and you can use the primal dual theory with all of that or predictor corrector methods to solve that and other techniques. The number of constraints is very high. The interior point methods, Henry went through it in more detail, of course, in a higher level with semi-definite programming. You are looking at solutions that are in the interior. Sometimes, of course, you have non-feasible interior point methods where you can start outside. There is an identified central path, and the techniques, depending on how they take the steps, will stay close to that central path and find the optimal solution, usually in a small number of iterations. The big deal, of course, here in slowing this down as any technique, even though it's polynomial time, is the solution of the Newton step. So in solving for that step, you can actually find quite a bit, you can spend quite a bit of time solving that. What we do here is we actually use some matrix reordering techniques to keep everything in the constraints as much as you want along the diagonal. There's several techniques to do this. We have one technique that works quite well that we use here, but there's other methods that have been set up for actually minimum degree ordering algorithms, etc., that are embedded in many of the codes that are very nice as is. We use local. Bob Vanderbilt's code from Princeton. It works quite well for these kinds of problems, and the new version of Loco is actually dynamite because it does a very good matrix reordering and solves it much faster than even their previous version, the last version. The proposed method we have, we actually use an eigenvector-based technique to actually reduce the amount of bandwidth of the constraints. So we actually order the rows and the columns, the variables, so that we keep everything along a diagonal, so we can solve it as efficiently as possible, and it works quite well. So for example, what we use in our technique using this eigenvector approach is that we start with a matrix that looks like this. By the way, these are the assignment constraints that the roots must be chosen to be in one, and only one of those must be chosen per net. And then we have the edge constraints of what goes through the edges that looks very, very sparse. And we permute the rows and columns and get things that look along a band down this way, and that helps in solving the interior point method. The code has developed quite a number of programs, including C programs, C++. If anybody wants these programs or wants to play with them, we have a MATLAB interface. You're very welcome to do so. This is all public domain, and I'd be very happy to make Lale send you, have you access her directory so you can actually get the programs and try it for yourself, and more than welcome to play with these. And there's a MATLAB program to perform the matrix reordering and rounding, and the MATLAB program for visual illustration, so you actually see the congestion and how it actually operates. Running times on this, on the interior point method, without reordering, which are in green, for these six problems that we looked at, the small problems really wasn't a big deal. But as you get to these back-end problems, you start seeing the effect of ordering on the larger problems. It's very dramatic. The running time, even with the computed time of reordering, which is very small, it's got to be fast, it's cut in half. It's cut in half. And this is with Bob Vanderbilt's code. It works really, really well. Conclusions. What I've talked about today is really we've incorporated congestion into global routing so that it leads to compact problems, a very small set of problems that we can solve that give high-quality solutions. The results, as I said, show that we can deal with different measures, including wire length, area, delays. We can deal with that all together simultaneously. And the last part is that the matrix reordering is an effective technique for reducing the LP running time. As I said, my main objective when I came here today was to talk, certainly I had to talk about routing, but what I wanted to talk to you as an audience is really about what's out there in the computer-aided design community, which I think is very, very exciting for mathematicians that are working in optimization. Colleagues like Henry and Tamash and others that I think partially converted to working on this have really been able, I think, to add to that area quite a sophisticated way so that we can solve even much larger problems. And what's interesting, for example, is right now, this gets back to what Henry was talking about, if I can link the two talks, the semi-definite programming really is right now, I think, at the same point interior point was when I started using it for solving these problems in the early 90s, after about 5 or 6 years of all the stuff that Karmarker and others had developed. What the practitioners like Henry and others have developed on semi-definite programming is so ripe for many of the remaining hard discrete optimization problems that designers are looking for. And they're not necessarily that big because, as you know, semi-definite programming is limited, of course, to the size because of some of the issues of how you solve it efficiently. Macro cell layout, for example, is one area where you're looking at chips within chips that are being designed. Those are only about 50 to 200 areas that you actually have to lay out inside a chip. Semi-definite programming holds a great opportunity to solve those problems effectively and get fantastic bounds that have never been seen so the designers really know where that's going. Offsetting it with time at this stage, but I think as these methods become more sophisticated and are able to solve bigger problems and those hurdles are overcome, with the work that Henry and others are doing, I think it leads to more promise on these kind of real practical problems. So I hope that some of you that are interested in doing this, certainly afterwards, can talk to me, or even after today, follow up. I'd be very happy to show this work, and if I can convert more of you, this sort of missionary work I'm doing, it's a great area to work in, and there's some great opportunities to move this work further. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Any questions?